This is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Just what can you say in the pulpit as a Christian minister? What can you say in terms of our constitutional guarantee of the freedom of religious expression? Free exercise. Just what can or can you not say? I mean, that's what it comes down to. The challenge letter sent by the Internal Revenue Service to a church in Pasadena, California, warning that a sermon preached the Sunday before the election in 2004 simply put that church over the line in terms of political involvement. Now, I've taken a very close look at this, and we're going to do that together starting in the second segment. We're going to have the rector of that church with us, and I want to tell you what makes this particularly interesting. I don't think you could find a more liberal church in America. I don't think you could find a church that, frankly, shares with me less in terms of conviction and less in terms of worldview and less in terms of concern about the specific issues that that pastor chose to address. But here's the deal. If it is unconstitutional for him to speak that way, if it violates the separation of church and state, if it endangers the tax exemption of that church, for him to preach that way on the basis of his theological convictions, then our right and liberty is just as endangered. And it is important not only as an exercise in intellectual integrity, but also just in terms of the protection of freedom that we take a close look at this, and we'll do that beginning in the next segment. First of all, this is November the 11th in the year 2005, 87 years ago, in the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of the year 1918, the armistice was put into effect that ended the war we now know as World War I. It's interesting, isn't it? I can remember one time talking to a teenager, and he said, how come the people who lived then didn't call it World War I? Well, let's figure that one out. They didn't know it was going to be one of two. They called it the Great War. It was called at various times the War to End All Wars or the War for Democracy. It turned out to be a war that merely set the stage for an even more catastrophic war to come. Armistice Day in 1918 was declared a national holiday. It has been observed ever since. It was later transformed into Veterans Day when the World War I veterans who survived that awful conflagration were joined by veterans from successive wars. Historians now suggest that we ought to look back and see that the 20th century, in terms of its first half, was not really divided into two great cataclysmic world wars, but one. One tremendously tragic world war that was interrupted by a very brief and very artificial peace. World War I ended 87 years ago today. There's a fascinating twist in that tale, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But let's remind ourselves today that there are still some veterans of World War I among us. How many? Well, the Veterans Bureau says that there are 8. That is, out of almost 300 million Americans, there are 8 soldiers, veterans of World War I, currently drawing veterans' benefits. Those who look into such things estimate that there may be between 30 and 50 veterans of World War I alive, only 8 drawing the benefits. You know, gentlemen, if there is any way you can hear me, God bless you. We're thankful for you. We honor you today. And one of the ways we're going to honor your sacrifice for your country is to talk about what World War I really represented. This was a war that began in a way that still leaves people scratching their heads. No one to this day is really sure what this world war was all about. The Germans and the French and the Russians and the British had been at each other. The Germans were following a militaristic plan under the Kaiserreich, the reign of the last of the Hohenzollern monarchs, Wilhelm II, the German emperor. He felt that Germany's pride, that Germany's status in the world could be reset by a great war in which Germany would be the victor, recapturing territory that had been lost in previous campaigns, uniting all the German-speaking people under a great German Reich. Boy, that came back to haunt us all, didn't it, in the 20th century? Of course, World War I, in terms of its effect, saw the end of three great dynasties, the Romanov dynasty in Russia, the Habsburg dynasty in Austria-Hungary, and the Hohenzollern dynasty in Germany, and what had been called, until just before World War I, Prussia. Folks, World War I proves, as if we need proof, the inhumanity of human beings, the absolute sinfulness and evil of which we are capable. Most of us today have very little memory in terms even of our historical consciousness of what World War I really represented. You had armies massed against each other with brutal new technologies such as machine guns and with awful weapons of mass destruction such as poison gas. And they faced each other off and their generals sent them into senseless battle with millions and millions of casualties over yards and feet of useless, meaningless terrain. Now, war is sometimes necessary. It must always be the least of evils possible. There are things worse than war, but we certainly should look back at World War I and say this was a senseless conflict that left everyone devastated, that left nothing decided, and led to the carnage of millions of lives lost. In Great Britain, an entire generation of young men simply disappeared. 600,000 widows in France, 1 million fatherless children in France alone. Germany so devastated and with the repressive peace that was put upon her in the Treaty of Versailles just set the stage for the kind of unrest that would lead to World War II. A young German corporal by the name of Adolf Hitler, who had been gassed and had been wounded and had been cited for bravery in battle, saw the fall of the Kaiserreich and was determined that Germany's reputation and stature must, just as Kaiser Wilhelm had said, be won back through military conquest and through the oppression of other peoples for Lebensraum, living room, for the people of the German-speaking lands. We're talking about generals who sent their armies into battle, knowing that there were human bodies running into the face in this trench warfare of machine guns. The carnage was just awful. This was one of the first wars that really gripped the Western imagination after the medieval period. That is, Western civilization was haunted by this war. The myth of human progress, because when you look back at the Victorian age and you look back at the 19th century, so many in Europe and in America were driven by a sense that human beings were getting better and better, that progress was the very course of history, and that ran into the ground of the killing fields of Verdun and the Meuse and these other awful places where so many thousands and millions died. Tragically, this particular war produced some of the most moving poetry in the history of warfare. Just remember the words of Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae in Flanders Fields. He said this, "In Flanders Field the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below." The wasted young lives are commemorated with these words by Siegfried Sassoon. "We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow." Sassoon spoke of the plight of the common British soldier. He said this, "Tonight he's in the pink, but soon he'll die. And the war goes on. He don't know why." Arthur Jensen, an American survivor of the war, considered what the German dead would say to their American victors. "We are the dividends of war. We're what you came to Europe for. Our cause is lost. We died in vain. And now we're rotting in the rain." Millions of bodies were never recovered. Millions of funerals were never held. And here is the bitter irony. The armistice that ended the war was signed early in the morning, but it was dated 5 hours later. The war could have ended 5 hours before it did, because generals decided that even though the war had been won in terms of the armistice, they wanted to press their advantage to take one more village, one more mountain, one more trench. And there were over 10,000 casualties between that early morning signing of the treaty and when the armistice came into effect at 11 o'clock a.m. A lot of us just can't even imagine this, and I have to say, I think in our mass technology communications, internet-driven age, it'd be almost impossible for this to happen in our times, but it tells us something about human nature, and those of us who look at this from the perspective of the Christian worldview know that this is a demonstration of the utter sinfulness of sin, the self-deception of evil, the ugly costliness and horror of war, and we should see this as a warning. The United States Army 79th Division received this order at 9 o'clock in the morning. Hostilities will cease on the whole front at 11 hours today, French time. Until that hour, the operations previously ordered will be pressed with vigor, At 11 hours, our line will halt in place, and no man will move one step forward or backward. That left that particular division of the U.S. Army 2 more hours to die. For land, they would be given by surrender in just 2 hours. Folks, if nothing else, this reminds us not only of the price that is required to defend liberty, but of the evil that is always so close to us in the awful horror of war. It's perhaps good for us to reflect on this on Veterans Day, not only to honor the veterans of World War I, but all those who have ever served and are serving even now. We'll be back to talk about some of those liberties they're defending. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Well, there's a lot of attention being given to a letter from the IRS. I guess just about any time anyone gets a letter from the IRS, it gets a little bit of attention. But when it's addressed to a church, it takes on a special significance. And this church is the All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California. A news story broke just over the weekend that this church had received a warning letter from the IRS that goes back to a sermon that was preached on the Sunday before the 2004 national election, in particular the presidential election. And this letter warned that a sermon that had been preached on that Sunday by a former rector of the church, George Rodriguez, had violated IRS guidelines in terms of political speech. Now, the IRS guidelines, frankly, are somewhat subjective, but they suggest that a church can't intervene in an election, can't endorse a candidate. Well, what does that then leave? Well, for most of American history, even since the creation of the IRS and since the modifications of the tax code in the 1950s, it has been assumed that a church can speak on the basis of its own religious convictions without fear of interference from the IRS unless it does endorse a candidate, and that rather explicitly, or intervene specifically in an election. Now, folks, I just want to tell you right up front, as a conservative evangelical, I recognize that I'm looking at a church that is very, very distant from where I am. If you were to look at the spectrum of American Protestantism, All Saints would be at one end and I'd be somewhere near the other. And all I can say is that makes this all the more important, because if we really believe in religious liberty, we don't believe in religious liberty merely for ourselves. We have to believe in it for everyone. And if we believe in the liberty of the pulpit, we can't believe in it merely for our churches, but for all churches. And if we're not going to defend a church that it is going to speak for a different message than we would want to speak, then who's going to speak for us when the IRS comes knocking at our door? We're very pleased to have today as a guest on the program Ed Bacon, who is the rector of All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California. Pastor Bacon, we're glad to have you.
I'm glad to be with you. If you'll play just as I am, I'll come down the aisle and join your church.
Well, I tell you what, that would be a fascinating experience. I would look forward to an even longer conversation with you about a lot of these issues, because this is a fascinating story. But I really feel like our listeners need to understand what's going on here.
Sure.
Now, just tell me, how is your church responding to this letter from the IRS?
Well, actually, our church is quite energized. It has given us an opportunity to spread our core values to a wider audience than we ever could have hoped for. So we are quite challenged, energized, animated by all this attention, and we are actually quite grateful to the IRS for giving us this platform.
Well, I understand exactly what you mean there, and you have been given a platform. I mean, a lot of people, and by the way, folks need to know that All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena is one of the largest churches in the ECUSA, the Episcopal Church USA. And it's a church that is known for taking very liberal positions. I don't know exactly how, Pastor, you would stylize those, but there's no doubt that you've taken strong positions on homosexuality and abortion and any number of other issues. But, it just seems strange to me that this particular sermon would have attracted this attention. Does it seem strange to you?
It does seem very strange to me. In fact, that is the concern that all of us have across the theological and political spectrum, because what is at stake here is much larger than All Saints Church, as you so eloquently stated in your lead-in. What's at stake here is freedom of speech and freedom of religion. And our conservative brothers and sisters, as well as our liberal and progressive brothers and sisters, have really come to stand in solidarity with us. And everybody just instinctively knows what's at stake.
Now, if you could help me to kind of recreate the actual event, were you pastor of the church at that time?
Yes, I've been here for 10 years. And Dr. Regas is our former rector, and he is an eloquent, passionate preacher. And I thought it would be important to have him come in and preach on the Sunday prior to the election.
And were you there?
Oh, yes. And he preached a magnificent sermon, which held up our core values of being anti-war and in favor of the alleviation of poverty. And he preached a sermon, which in effect was, what would Jesus say to John Kerry and to George Bush? And what he did was do a masterful job of talking about the moral failure of this war in Iraq and its impact on the least of these in this country in terms of the growing poverty rolls of the U.S.
Now, I'm just trying to imagine, when you were sitting there, did you expect anything like this letter? When you heard the sermon, did you think, oh, no, we're going to get in trouble over this?
Oh, no, because this sermon was quite within the bounds of the IRS regulations. I'm a fan of these IRS regulations. I think they're quite wise. They don't prohibit a church from articulating its core values. In fact, they expect that. They don't even enjoin political action as long as you're not doing that as your full-time job, you know, not taking more than 5 or 10 or 15% of your time and money doing that. What is very, very clear, which I think is a really golden kind of sacred boundary that they've drawn in these IRS regulations, is that you cannot explicitly endorse a candidate for office, and you cannot explicitly oppose a candidate for office. And Dr. Regas explicitly said that he was not advocating one versus the other. In fact, he went on to say that he knew that there were people in the sound of his voice, within the sound of his voice, with profound faith, who would on Tuesday vote for Bush and would vote for Kerry. So then he went on to talk about the core values of All Saints Church, which we believe are the core values of Jesus.
Well, you know, I would fight for your right to have the freedom in your pulpit to preach that kind of message or to have that kind of message preached. And when I listened to it, and I did listen to the entire message, and Dr. Regas is very articulate, and I would certainly want to argue with him on many different points if we ever had the opportunity to sit across a table. But I mean, certainly, I do believe that Jesus cared deeply about the poor, and that Jesus cared deeply about peacemaking, and I think Christians can have a very substantial and responsible, mature discussion about how to see those goals accomplished. But right now, my concern is the freedom for either of us to be able to stand in our pulpit and preach about the regime, for that matter, even about the government and about the pressing political issues of the day, the moral issues that from Christian conscience demand our attention. I'm trying to imagine, what would we do if we were a Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Germany in terms of the freedom of that pulpit, which was denied? And we see that as an illustration. And what would we do in terms of the civil rights movement in the United States if the pulpit had to be, according to what I would see from the letter that you were warned about, almost AWOL from that kind of action? I mean, how do you respond to something like that?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer looms large in our memory. And I think that if we don't band together and fight this egregious, pernicious insertion into our pulpits, then we have failed to be responsible American Christian patriots. Democracy is at stake here. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion are clearly at stake here. And if we don't reach across boundaries the way you're doing so generously this afternoon, then we could lose something that is very precious and I think quite sacred.
Dr. Bacon, let me ask you, are you worried about this? Are you worried that this is going to go badly for your congregation?
Really not. I haven't had one moment of worry about this. I haven't had one moment of anxiety. I think that truth will prevail. I think justice will prevail and liberty will prevail because of good people like you and everyone else who's gathering around us. And even if the IRS position prevails for a moment. It will only be for a moment. And I think that the people of the United States of America will gather together and find a way to fight that.
Well, I hope and I believe you're right. Our guest today has been Dr. Edwin Bacon, who is the rector of All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California. Pastor, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, if you come up to me a week ago and said, look, I want to tell you who you're going to have as a guest on your show next week, the rector of the All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California, I would have thought you were nuts. Now, something has to explain this, and what explains it is this letter from the IRS. Now, again, let me be right up front with you. This church is on the left wing of the Episcopal Church USA. On matters of doctrine, on matters of theology, on matters of biblical teaching, such as homosexuality and abortion, this church is way, way out there. So why was the rector on? Because his church has received this letter. And by the way, the IRS actually sent them a letter that said, if you will plead guilty to this and agree never to do it again, we won't go to the next step. Well, what is that? Now, let me say right up front, I have some sympathy for the Internal Revenue Service. They are, of course, a bureaucratic organization. They're a government agency. They have to deal with massive questions and with millions of tax responses and filings and laws and regulations and all the rest. And somebody there has to be making some decisions. This is in the line. This is outside the line. I can't explain what brought this particular letter about. This is a prominent church, yes. Maybe it got a lot of media attention. And as a matter of fact, the IRS pointed to a November 4, 2004 article that appeared in the Los Angeles Times as the reason why it knew about this and was taking on the case. But I want to say something, and I want you to hear this, folks, very clearly. What this particular pastor said in that pulpit is something that I would by no means say. And, you know, it's just right up front, not the message that I would have preached. But when you look at it, if this message is too political, even though he did not endorse a candidate. Now, did he criticize President Bush? Oh, yes, he did. Did he criticize John Kerry? Yes, although much more mildly than President Bush. Did he talk about political issues? Yes, he talked about the war. Oh, did he talk about the war? Did he talk about poverty? Yes, and he talked about all kinds of things. And he talked about abortion. Yes, and he talked about other things. And, you know, boy, let me tell you, I could just start to take all that stuff apart and take weeks. But that's not the point. Because that very same Sunday, in a lot of evangelical churches, thousands of evangelical churches around the country, there were pastors getting up to talk about some of those same issues on the basis of their Christian conviction. And yes, they did want their church members to bring their faith with them right into the voting booth. And they did feel like it was important for them to say, look, when you vote, vote to defend human life when it comes to abortion. When you vote, vote to defend marriage on issues like homosexuality. When you come to vote, vote to defend these values that are dear to us because we believe they are important to Christian conviction. Well, you can't have the one without the other. I can't be free to preach that message, and would I endorse a candidate? No. But let's not be naive here. If you're talking about America in the 21st century, you're talking about polarities of politics that mean that when I speak about the sanctity of human life, and I speak about the need to bring an end to abortion, and I speak about the need to defend marriage, and I speak about the need to uphold biblical standards of sexuality, and that the laws would reflect that in terms of responding to a respect for marriage. Let's not be coy here. There are political ramifications to what is said. You can't have a civil rights movement without being able to say the law is wrong. And when it comes to an election, people are going to have to draw their own conclusions, but they shouldn't have to go back to ground zero. The church has the responsibility to speak from its deepest convictions. Listen to this one clip from Pastor George Regas preaching in that sermon that got him into trouble.
Good people of profound faith will be voting for both Senator Kerry and President Bush. I think they will be voting for reasons deeply rooted in their faith. I want you to hear that.
Okay, let me just say that an evangelical preacher could have preached an entire sermon in the amount of time it took that man to say that much, okay? So we're talking about a different cadence going on here. But there's something very important for him to be able to address this this particular election. Go on, listen to what he said to President Bush as he said what Jesus would say to him in clip number two. Guys, roll it.
And Jesus continues, Mr. President, your doctrine of preemptive war is a failed doctrine. Forcibly changing the regime of an enemy that posed no imminent threat has led to disaster.
Now, my guess is a lot of you would want to argue about what he said. Well, I understand that. That's not the point. Would you argue about his right to say it? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program, and boy, this just shows the issues will come in very surprising ways. The real question is how we'll respond to it. The number, 877-893-8255. I'm Albert Mueller. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. This is a fascinating discussion, and when you look at the particular sermon we're talking about here, you realize it's kind of a mirror image of what a lot of us heard on the Sunday before the election, on the conservative evangelical side. This is the other side, and we are living in an age in which there is so much distance between the liberal and conservative wings in non-Catholic Christianity, also within Catholicism. That's a different story. But just to take non-Catholics, you've got an enormous span between theological liberals and theological conservatives. Now, that's not to say there's no common ground. We would agree about the necessity of a mandate for justice and righteousness. The question is how you go about that and what the particular issues are that would demand a Christian response. Very different positions on homosexuality, marriage, abortion, you name it, the war. Many other things, just or war in general. But again, I'm going to argue that if this church doesn't have the freedom to preach from its conviction as it understands and embraces them, then we will not have that freedom either. Let's go to Jeff calling from Palm Harbor, Florida, listening to WTBN. Jeff, you're welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. Glad to have you. What do you think?
I think unequivocally they have the right to speak that from the podium.
All right. Do you have any concerns? Would you say, look, there are certain boundaries that were crossed? When you're looking at this, what would it take in terms of the IRS guidelines for you to kind of pull the trigger? Endorsing a candidate?
Well, I'm not sure I understand that question. All I'm saying is that, first of all, it all goes back to the separation of church and state thing, which is really not a legitimate concern because it's really not an issue. It shouldn't be an issue, but it's been made an issue. So it really doesn't matter. However, I just believe that they do have the right to speak what they should speak from the podium. They used to speak that 100 years ago. The preachers always guided the people into making decisions years ago, and now all of a sudden they can't do it anymore.
Well, Jeff, I appreciate your call. You know, the reality is that the IRS guidelines are rather arbitrary. And by the way, they were put there by Lyndon Johnson as when he was a senator. He really orchestrated having those guidelines put in there. And they were put in there in order to protect then-Senator Lyndon Johnson from criticism he was getting from some churches in Texas. And now we're living with the legacy. And there is a lot of subjectivity here. I mean, again, I have some sympathy for the IRS. I mean, how are they supposed to apply the rule that says you can't endorse a candidate? Well, I look at this, and nowhere in this sermon, I listened to the entire thing. I read the entire thing, and I've listened to the entire thing. At no point did he say vote for John Kerry. He did insinuate that a Christian ought not to vote for George Bush, but he never actually said that. And I would have to say, in all honesty, I'm certain that in a lot of evangelical churches, you heard almost the opposite, given concerns about the family, marriage, abortion, and other things. Let's go to Paul calling from Cleveland, Ohio, listening on WHKW. Paul, it's your turn.
Yes, it sounds like this church that we're talking about is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation.
Yeah, churches were basically grandfathered into that. Churches don't have to apply for it. They're just assumed to have it.
It's not required to have that 501c3 And if you do take it, then they require you to comply with these certain laws. But my Bible says that Christ is the head of the church, and if you establish your church and you don't become a 501c, you only have one head of your church. But when you enjoin yourself to the state, then all of a sudden you have your church has two heads, and it no longer becomes a church, but a two-headed monster.
Well, and, you know, I would accept that logic up to a point, Paul, but let me ask you, are you a member of a church?
Yes, I am.
Is it tax-exempt?
Every church is tax-exempt, but it's not a 501c3. It's not. There's no requirement that that people do this. There's a lot of organizations, nonprofit organizations, that want to.
Churches are still, Paul, come under the IRS 501c3 regulations. That's why this is about. There is no church that is tax exempt that the IRS does not consider to be under these same regulations.
Yeah, well, you're wrong.
No, I'm not. I'm fundamentally, absolutely not wrong. If your church, if your pastor gets up and says, vote for candidate X rather than candidate Y, you can have your tax exemption revoked.
Talk to Pastor Ernie Sanders at Doers of Word.
I'm sure he's the national expert on this, sir, but I'll let you talk to him. Let's go to George calling from Sterling, Virginia, listening on XM Satellite Radio. George, it's your turn.
Albert, I'm going to badly paraphrase a Lutheran minister, in the World War II era, who said, when they came for the Jews, I didn't speak up because it didn't affect me. I wasn't Jewish. When they came for the gypsies, I didn't speak up because it didn't affect me. But when they came for me, there was nobody to speak up for me. I think we have to defend, any minister's right to preach as he sees fit. Otherwise, they'll come after us.
Yes, you're paraphrasing Pastor Martin Niemöller in Germany, who made that statement. And, of course, he made it in retrospect. It was too late. And that's one of the reasons why I think we have to be very careful to say, look, if this church can get in trouble, then my church can get in trouble. Because the tax exemption that is granted to churches is not something that's in the Constitution. You won't find it there. It is instead granted there by federal statute. And that federal statute brings all churches under this regulation. My church is not IRS 501c3. Most churches are not. Most churches across America aren't even incorporated. Most of them have made no filing for IRS C3 anywhere because churches were grandfathered in that legislation. But they were also all put under this. For instance, I know of a church that received one of these letters, and it's not registered as an IRS 501c3. And the fact is that we can thank Lyndon Johnson and the United States Congress for this back in the 1950s, but it is coming back to haunt us even now. Now, at the same time, let me just say, I don't believe, and George, I don't think you mean this either, I don't believe that the church should be turned into a political action committee. I don't believe that politics should be our main concern. No one is going to be saved by politics. No one is going to be in the kingdom of God because of the decisions that are made by a government in this country in terms of changing their hearts. No law, no legislation can accomplish that. But the Christian gospel does have a political dimension to it, necessarily. Even the freedom to say, as the first Christians had to say, that Jesus Christ is Lord and not Caesar. That is a political statement. And our freedom to say that without either losing our tax exemption or being put into jail, that's at stake whenever anyone is threatened with this kind of letter. Now, I don't know how this is going to come down. I don't know who in the end is going to win in this, but let me tell you, I don't think you've seen anything like outrage that you would see if the IRS starts going church by church, listening to sermons and trying to make judgments in these matters. And by the way, I don't think the IRS wants that job. But this is one of those wake-up calls for all of us that demands our attention. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We've been talking about this issue that is really localized at All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California, and I do think it's important. This is a church that has found itself confronted by the IRS because of the blanket tax-exempt provision that was grandfathered in for churches. But it's not unconditional. That's the thing. It is not unconditional. Now, let me say, I think in retrospect I got a little hot with Paul. So, Paul, when you were pressing the point, let me just say, no personal animosity here, but I just have to disagree with you on that, and I would encourage you just to look it up. And, you know, quite frankly, I've had enough knowledge and experience in this to know that the IRS will consider no tax-exempt organization tax-exempt by God. It's tax-exempt by Congress, and they will apply the congressional statute to the determination of tax exemption. So this is a big question for us, and it really comes down to our intellectual integrity, whether we're going to acknowledge that our freedom is tied to the freedom of others. And it comes down also to our integrity to say, look, as much as we consider these issues to be of ultimate importance, I mean, after all, the freedom to talk about political issues is a small thing compared to the freedom to talk about the gospel. That is the issue. But who decides what the gospel is? I mean, isn't that the big question here? Who decides what is an authentic representation of gospel preaching? You know, I don't want some bureaucrat in Washington or in some field office deciding that. I want the church to decide that. And for the freedom for my church to make that determination requires the freedom of other churches to make that same determination. Now, within the world of Christianity and Christian theology, boy, do we need to debate these issues. And if I ever had the opportunity to have Dr. Bacon on to talk about some of these questions like biblical authority and homosexuality and marriage and all the rest, I'm confident that would be a fascinating discussion. But you know what? As much as I cannot celebrate what his church preaches, as much as I would be even heartbroken to know some of the things that are almost assuredly preached and taught there, I have to fight for their right to do that if I want to claim the same. Now, we're not living in a police state, and I'm not sending off flares warning that the feds are coming. This is not some kind of conspiracy theory we're talking about. This is a reminder to us that eternal vigilance really is the prize and the price of liberty. We have to watch. We have to think. We have to be aware. And we have to be ready to articulate a case for religious liberty in a generation that has taken it for granted for far too long. This week, news reports came that a pastor in China has been arrested for printing Bibles. It's a long way away. It's not the issue here. But it ought to be on our concern as well. Religious liberty is just too important not to defend. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.